I'm Karen Collins, and I live in New York City and work at the National Council of Churches. I've worked there for 6 years, and for the first four of that, I worked on child advocacy issues, mostly child care issues. My background is as an early childhood educator. I went have my my master's degree from Bank Street College of Education in New York City, and have done some doctoral work at Teachers College in Family Policy. But for the last year and a half, I've been spending a lot of my time working on something that we call the Ecumenical Child Health Project, which is a project that the first piece of which was research. And we're just completing that phase where we surveyed congregations across the country in 16 different denominations, including the ELCA and other major Protestant denominations, to find out something about what congregations are already doing in terms of addressing the health needs of people in their congregations, children and older members as well. So I never had formal medical training or health training, although I have worked on health projects with migrant families and families in the Ozarks. But I come to it more from as an educator. So I want to start by reading a biblical passage which is familiar to all of us, or to most of us, I would imagine. It's the passage about Jairus' daughter, which was actually read, I believe it was read last night in Vespers. It's from Matthew 9, 18 to 19, and from 23 to 26. Suddenly a leader of the synagogue came in and knelt before Jesus, saying, "My daughter has just died. But come and lay your hand on her, and she will live." And Jesus got up and followed him with his disciples. And then there's another story in between. The last part of this story goes, "When Jesus got to the leader's house and saw the flute players and the crowd making a commotion, he said, 'Go away, for the girl is not dead, but only sleeping.' And they laughed at him. But when the crowd had been put outside, he went in, and he took her by the hand, and the girl got up. And the report of this was spread throughout the district." And I think this is very important as a story which tells us about healing of children, and particularly tells us about perhaps healing in situations which we are told to be impossible. Not to be frightened by the impossible, but to believe and to have faith that we can turn difficult situations around. Along that same line, I'd like to just read this one quotation from a 4th century desert father together, because I think it speaks to our goal, I believe it's our shared goal, of ensuring that all children in this society get the health care they need and deserve, and that we will in the future develop a universal access system in this country which will ensure that all people get the health care they need and deserve. "Fear not this goodness," let's read it together.
"Fear not this goodness as a thing impossible, nor the pursuit of it as something alien, set a great way off. It hangs on our own choice."
I obviously think that this, perhaps not obviously, but I believe this quotation can be applied to a lot of our work, not only necessarily to the area of child health, but to all areas in which we as people of faith go to make a difference in our world and in the lives of people around us. But let's go back and talk specifically about children for a while. What I'd like to do is begin by starting about what are the health problems that are facing children in this country today. And I'd like to put a list together. And as we go, feel free to jump in with your particular expertise out of your experience, be that from your interaction with children or your specific medical knowledge or whatever you're bringing to the situation. But let's talk about what are the health problems facing poor children in particular.
Do you all want to come a little closer? We're going to be a very small group.
I don't have a terribly loud voice. Do you want to just come up, bring your chairs a little bit closer, and then we'll be able to hear each other better? Does that make sense?
Your chairs.
Yeah.
Well, you know, if you want to start at the beginning, the first problem is during prenatal.
Here. You know what? I'm going to bring the board closer. You guys can sit
in one of those chairs.
This much closer.
There you go.
That's right. That's not a seat, but it's got concrete feet, right? Okay. Lack of prenatal.
Access to prenatal care because of cost is one thing.
Okay, so it would be lack of access. You know what? We'll have a whole prenatal care, okay? And the first thing under that you would say is lack of access due to.
You could say that is true.
Right.
And there would also be nutrition and substance, nutrition mm-hmm. for and substance abuse.
Okay. You know, as we're going through, do you know some of the statistics that you want to, do you want to develop that at all? Okay, why don't as we're going then, why don't I mention some of the statistics go along with us, okay? Well, why do you say first, why do you mention prenatal care first? I mean, why do you consider that to be?
Well, I think that's the answer. It starts in terms of, start with the child's life.
Right.
That's when the first things that can go wrong.
That's right. Yeah. And it's probably the cheapest and most effective way of avoiding low birth weight and other problems that in child health. So that prenatal care is absolutely critical. Well, the statistics are that in 1988, only 3/4 of the women in this country got early prenatal care. That means starting in the first 3 months of life, which is what we believe to be critical. The United States has set goals for the year 2000 for a variety of different areas of health care and health. And these goals are modifications of 1990 goals that were set by the Surgeon General because we didn't come close to meeting most of our goals last year. So our goal for 1990 is that 90% of women will get prenatal care in the first trimester. When you're talking about the Black community, it's only 61%. And when you're talking about the Latino community, it's also 61%. Okay. In terms of nutrition, while the goal for the year 2000 is that 85% of all pregnant women will gain adequate weight during their pregnancies, the goal this past year was only 67%. Only two-thirds of the women in this country who were pregnant gained adequate weight during their pregnancies, which speaks to a variety of things, including lack of nutrition. 16% of children, low-income children, experience growth retardation. Much of this related to nutrition, lack of good nutrition.
16%.
And our goal for the year 2000 is 10%. In terms of iron deficiency among poor children, 1/5 of all children under the age of 2 are iron deficient. And 10% of 3- and 4-year-olds are iron deficient. 8% of women of childbearing age are anemic. Our goal is 3% for the year 2000.
Does some of this cross economic boundaries too? I mean, affluent children who are not
absolutely.
Eating well.
Yeah. Absolutely. But we're focusing on poor children because that's where the greatest need is. But you're absolutely right. I mean, it does cross boundaries.
You're saying our goal, are you saying a national goal?
The national goal, right. The goal set by the federal government is 3%. In the areas, I don't have stats. I mean, I have substance abuse with me. But clearly that is an issue. Okay, what else, what's another problem? Welcome.
Thank you. Sorry I'm late, but I'm a little slow these days.
No problem. No problem.
Never did get my coffee this morning. So if I go sit here and go to sleep, you'll know. It's not true.
All right, no problem. What's your name?
Doris Edmund.
Uh-huh, and where are you from?
Hmm?
Where are you from?
I'm from Thousand Oaks, California.
Great.
She's a Holden pioneer.
Ah.
I taught teachers in early childhood education there in the grad school for quite a few years.
Wonderful.
And finally there comes a time when you have to quit. Nobody told me to quit, but I told myself I'd better quit.
It's a wonderful profession. That's my background as well, early childhood education. Okay, we're talking about what are the health problems that face children in our country today. And we have so far identified a lack of prenatal care during pregnancy, nutrition, and substance abuse. What else?
Environmental factors, lead poisoning, air pollution, just conditions that you find in poor housing in inner city.
Okay.
This is moving away from prenatal, is it, or also?
I think we're moving, I'm sorry.
We're moving on.
Okay, environmental, including air pollution, lead poisoning, and poor housing. In terms of poor housing, were you thinking beyond lead poisoning? You were thinking of?
Oh, I suppose.
Lack of heat?
Yeah, lack of heat. And
Basic hygiene.
Okay, good, good.
I don't know about water quality, I don't know if that's a problem.
Sure. I mean, in New York City, I know that a lot of these old buildings have got lead pipes.
Yeah.
And that's one of the major ways in which, I mean, particularly the hot water.
Yeah.
So that the lead leaches into the water. So yeah, I mean, and the low-income housing is the housing which doesn't get renovated. So the problem remains. Can you all hear? Am I talking loud enough?
I have an amplifier.
I usually have one. I don't. Dan, are you there? Could you bring in an amplifier, please? They usually have them set out right here. I'll get one for you if nobody responds,
thank you.
Okay? I'm sorry, so I put it up instead of heat. Okay.
Something that crosses, you know, both prenatal and environmental is a bit of parental smoking or maternal smoking, parental smoking. And I mean, it's a major factor, risk factor in premature delivery, and I think we've come to understand that it's a major risk factor in the respiratory diseases of childhood.
Okay, parental smoking is a major issue. There's actually been a whole flurry of articles in the New York Times recently about that, and about how it increases the likelihood of childhood illness and asthma, etc. That's good, and that's not a very recognized one. I think actually in churches, we are as negligent as other people in that we are not taking the issue of smoking as seriously as probably we should, nor are we setting an example as strongly as we could in terms of our own congregations and our own church spaces. Yeah. Okay, any other issues?
Thinking about barriers that clinics, there are barriers to healthcare other than costs, like, not having available clinics. So many kids get discontinuous care through ERs. Real episodic.
Could you hold that for a second? I think what I'd like to do is go through all a variety of health problems, and then we can ask the question, why do these problems exist, and deal with a whole category of barriers. Okay. Are there other health issues?
Immunizations. Poor immunization rate.
Okay. What we know at this point, Sorry.
What we know at this point is that between 70% and 80% of the children in this country are fully immunized. That means immunized against measles, mumps, diphtheria, polio, tetanus, meningitis, rubella.
Thank you.
I think those are the major ones. The goal for this country is 92% for children under the age of 2 and 95% for school-age children. Let me make sure I've got this working.
You said it was.
All right, but now I have to make it work. Now, does that work better?
Fine.
Good, all right. I hadn't used it before, so I'm glad it's working.
Oh, it makes a world of difference.
Good. Thanks very much. Okay. In addition to only reaching the level of 70% to 80% in this country across the board, there are pockets in this country where children are immunized to the rate of less than 50%. And that would certainly be in communities in New York City where I live, where there is what you're beginning to talk about, the inadequacies of clinics and practitioners and inadequacy of insurance, et cetera, et cetera. So insurance immunization is a major problem. And some people have said that the poor immunization rate is actually a warning flag for us about the deterioration of our public health system, and that we need to take this very seriously because it may portend other serious problems down the line that aren't as obvious at this point. Okay, any other health problems facing children in this country that we want to identify?
Trauma. Lack of use of seatbelts in child restraints. Lack of use of bicycle helmets.
How about emotional factors, too, that are connected with so many of these? You know,
okay.
I don't know if that's a fact or not, but one would think that.
Sure. So, tell me.
Well, I'm just thinking that, you know, with dysfunctional families because of substance abuse, or single parent families, or migrant workers having to move around a whole lot.
So we're talking about mental health issues?
Yeah, I mean mental health. Yeah, mental and emotional health. Just the stresses, even on people that have adequate financial resources. I don't know if that's myth or whether it's actually true.
I heard an interesting thing recently from a practitioner, a medical practitioner, who told me that that there's been recent research done that shows that maybe you can help me with this because I'm not a practitioner, but some of the same the ways in which AIDS inhibits the functioning of our immune system happens with stress, that stress acts on our body in similar ways, and I assume it's a sort of similar biochemical reactions or something, but there's evidently research done which shows the bottom line is that stress is an issue biologically that makes us sick. So that definitely stress is an issue.
Yeah, homeless kids moving from place to place.
Yeah,
all
stuff. All right. How about infant mortality? And that's more than a health issue. It's a life and death issue. Infant mortality in this country is 10 per 1,000 children. The goal set by the United States is 7 for the year 2000. With an infant mortality rate of 10 per 1,000, we rank 20th in the world, behind all the European industrialized countries and other countries as well. When we're talking about other communities within the United States, particularly the black community, the infant mortality rate is 17.6. And that rate would put us 32nd in the world, which is obviously a completely unacceptable rate given the enormous wealth of this country and the resources available to us. Low birth weight.
I
Okay, low birth weight? Low birth weight is critical because infants who are born too early or too small are 40 times as likely to die in the first month of life as other infants. We have approximately in this country 40,000 infant deaths annually, and 23,000 of those, it's estimated, are a direct consequence or can be directly linked to low birth weight. The current rate of low birth weight in this country is 6.9 per thousand, which ranks us 26th in the world. In some communities, particularly the African American community, the rate is 13 per thousand. So here again, we have a long ways to go. Are there any others that people can think of? I think that what's important, we mentioned several things which are not necessarily always considered to be health issues or issues addressed by the medical profession, such as smoking or accidents or stress. Some of these things that are not necessarily clinical, I mean, they obviously are, but they aren't always considered to be medical or health-related things. And yet, there are many, many things in our lives which are indeed elements of our health care. I mean, maintaining a good body weight is certainly important. What are some other ones? A lack of stress in your life. All the personal choices that we make. I've forgotten the figure now, but I just read something recently where something on the order of 75% or 80% of our health is actually closely dependent upon personal choices that we make rather than actual medical intervention. Is that accurate? Yeah, something like that.
Sounds
good.
And then actually, when we're talking about health, we need to think not only about the gross kinds of medical procedures, but also all those other things in our lives which will make us healthy people, all the preventive things that we as individuals and congregations can be doing and promoting in our communities to make our communities in general healthier places to be.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if this is a health problem or not, but many children are inactive because of television, physical fitness, just general physical fitness, strength and core.
No, you're absolutely right. That's a big problem. That's a physical problem, which is definitely a health problem, but it's also a child development problem in terms of their learning and their development. Right.
Another thing that occurs to me too is if you're talking about poor children, I think that lack of a sense of empowerment of their parents. Because
they're
poor,
it is
definitely a health issue for kids. I mean, there may be less of a feeling that child's health could be improved or that something can be done about.
Right. Mm-hmm. Good. Right, that sense of hopelessness or despair. Mm-hmm. Okay, let's talk about why these things exist. Okay. Obviously, the next step after talking about why they exist is what can we do about it. So we can be thinking about that as we're going through the why they exist. Okay.
Lack of money.
Okay. A lack of money, but spell that out a little bit. I mean, a lot of people don't pay full cost of care anyway, so it's when paying for medical care, it's more complicated than actual.
Well, I mean, there are a lot of people who don't qualify for Medicare, for instance.
So we're talking about the whole insurance
issue. Yeah. Well, it's a broader thing, but specifically that would be one issue.
Okay, can I? Sure.
Yeah.
Okay. So under lack of money is lack of insurance.
Mm-hmm. A feeling that each individual is responsible for providing his own health care rather than this. A community problem that belongs to all of us. I guess extreme individualism would be.
I think you could.
Can I just stop for a second? Can you hold it for a second? It's estimated that the number of people who are uninsured in this country, the estimates run between 35 and 40 million. The estimate that I have heard most often and tend to hold on to is 38 million. And let's see. Of those, approximately 10.7 million children under the age of 18 were uninsured in 1989. That's one in six children. And when you're talking about poor children or children of other racial ethnic backgrounds who are not white, one in five black children were uninsured and one in three Latino children were completely uninsured in this country. That means that their parents were not employed by an employer who provided health benefits, and they were not eligible for Medicaid or any of the other federal programs.
And even when you do have insurance, I wasn't insured under the present Church Health Plan, but previously, look, you had a $2,500 deductible. That's really quite a strong deterrent, too.
Okay. Actually, what we're finding also is that that there's a large proportion of the children who are uninsured actually have parents who are employed and have coverage, but that employers are less and less offering policies for dependents. So that companies were paying full cost of dependent coverage from the last decade fell from 51% to 32% in 1988. And dependent coverage is often around $3,000 a year, which is more than many families with young children in particular can afford to pay. So whether you're looking at, you know, cutting one necessity out of your budget, unfortunately, health insurance is often that necessity which has to go. Now, in the last year, there was a health insurance credit that was passed as a part of the child care bill, but it only amounts to $4,000 a year, and it's only obviously available to those people who are on employer policies which have that kind of a dependent option for them, dependent coverage option. So what we're talking about is a lot of people who are going to have children who are uncovered.
I was reading in a paper about a growing tendency to hire part-time workers, and then therefore, no benefits.
Right.
Would you repeat that statistic? It was only 38% of employers have dependent?
32% of employers pay full cost of dependent coverage. But what you're talking about is all those folks, the increasing number of people who are hourly, who are wage earners, mm-hmm. unsalaried people, for whom who receive no benefits whatsoever. And what's happened is partly, I think what you're alluding to, is there used to be a higher number of manufacturing jobs, relatively well-paid manufacturing jobs in this country, which have diminished. That number has diminished at the same time that more jobs, low-paid jobs in the service sector have increased, and many of those jobs don't carry benefits. So the net effect is that more people are uninsured.
Right. So, and that's one of the major points I would make, is that that's why the focus should not be on providing insurance for people, but for providing care for people. And they're two totally different issues.
Okay, which we'll talk more about when we're talking about universal access. Yeah, because that's very, very, very important. That's really, okay, good.
I think education is, information, you know, is very important, that people know how to make some kind of judgments about their children's health care and what is a problem, and that maybe practicing some soft or holistic medicine at home, something like that, preventative medicine, some uh-huh. information.
So particularly, especially about preventive care, or?
I
think so.
I think also...
Just wholesome living, I guess, and also identifying when a problem arises. I think some people are even paranoid, you know, it isn't a problem, or maybe they ignore a real problem to know when to identify that, just ordinary lay people.
I would think certainly nutrition is a very, very parental lack of information of proper nutrition.
And I would say also, lack of information, there are federal programs available that people simply don't know about. So it would be also a lack of information about services.
You really aren't automatically a good parent and know how to take care of your children's health.
The services that are available is really important to get out, particularly to the very most desperate people. They just don't know what is available.
And right now, I mean, the legislation in our Congress is changing fast enough, especially as regards Medicaid and eligibility levels and services that are available, that that a lot of that information is not there. I mean, it's actually a problem that some of the people who are social workers and agencies working with these people are not fully up to date on what those new services are, so that there's a there is an information lag at all different levels that we need to address. And of course, one of the questions might be, for example, is there a role for congregations to play? As community-based organizations, could congregations assist public health agencies and other practitioners in spreading information about available services, or about any of these things for that matter?
Or if the whole system was just less complex. When you mentioned social workers, there are some forms, or I read ones 142 pages long, and you have to have a professional to help you get some of these services, and it's so intricate, and then it, you just learn it and it changes.
Yeah.
And these are just to give people what they need.
Another reason why problems exist is that children are, they don't have a voice in our society, and they're often the last ones that are thought about in terms of social change. They don't have any PACs in Congress.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And that, therefore, we have to be that voice for those children. And that it really falls on us who do know what the situation is to organize that response and to organize that voice on behalf of those children. Just let me, you know, so that we make sure this happens, I would like, probably, maybe you know this organization, but there's an organization called the Children's Defense Fund in Washington, D.C., which I, to my mind, in my opinion, is probably the finest advocacy organization, child advocacy organization in the United States. They publish every year a book, which is called their Green Book, which is facts and figures about children in the United States, and it's everything from child care to homelessness to health care to poverty in general, and recommendations about what needs to be done about it, facts and figures, state by state, so that you can say, if you're from Kentucky, you can say exactly what the immunization, you will find out exactly what the immunization rate, for example, of children in your state is. They have all that information. They also recently published a book, this just came out in March. It's called Welcome the Child, and it's a book specifically developed for congregational use, for congregations who are interested in doing something about children, on issues related to children. And it goes through, again, some of those same issues with scriptural passages, sermon ideas, liturgies, hymns, poetry, then some basic facts and figures, some recommendations, ideas for how to get involved, and then also some worksheets about collecting information in your communities about the individual issue as a basis for then moving forward. But I would really recommend this for any congregation which is thinking about doing more work on child advocacy issues. It's very, very, very good.
Many churches have a health department now, and they have,
yes,
have a nurse that serves that congregation.
Right, that's more and more true. What are you thinking of specifically? Are you talking about, do you know of your church or a church in your community?
No, we have a committee, a health committee, but we don't have a specific, we haven't hired a nurse to do the work, and, you know, but I know they're talking about it and working on it.
Let's go back to that in just a minute, about what we can do. There was one other thing that I wanted to raise here, and then we'll go right to that point. There is also a shortage of health practitioners. There are 30 million people in this country who live in identified, what do they call them? In identified areas with a lack of health practitioners in underserved areas.
Rural and inner city, I suppose.
Right. Yes, yes, absolutely. Two-thirds of those people are children and women of childbearing age. And in addition to that, even if you do have insurance, even if you are in an area which is adequately served by practitioners, if you are one of those people who is on Medicaid, you may run into the problem that the practitioner won't accept Medicaid. There are one-third of the obstetricians in this nation will not accept Medicaid, and 20% of the pediatricians will not accept Medicaid. And those that do often will only accept a limited number. So that you might well find yourself in a situation where you think you have it all together, but then you can't find a practitioner who will accept you. So let's go on then to what we can do.
Can I say one more thing about
this? Yes, absolutely. I'm sorry.
And that is, there's underlying all this, there's a basic assumption that health care and health care access is a privilege and not a right in this country. And that really has got a lot to do with all of these things.
It's considered a privilege and not a right. It's considered a privilege and not a right.
Oh, I see.
He's saying that's for a lot of us.
So what you're saying is that what our assumption should be. So healthcare is a right, not a privilege. This is the way it should be, right?
That's correct.
But that is obviously not what's happening now. But as Christians, as people of faith, this is, I think, what our theology tells us. And this is probably what we should be working towards, which will bring us to a discussion of universal access, I think. But you were talking about in your congregation, or that you have a health committee. Mm-hmm. Can you just talk a little bit more about that?
I'm not on it, so I don't know what they're doing. I just know that there is one, that there is a concern for this type of, Granger Westberg, I think, has done a great deal in starting these.
Right. Granger Westberg wrote a book called The Parish Nurse, I believe.
Yes.
It's a whole system and idea of parish nursing. Are you all familiar with it? Or? Mm-hmm. It's the concept is that a congregation have a nurse in its midst. And that person worked anywhere from 10 hours a week to 30 or 40 hours a week, that he or she either be paid or volunteer, that there's a variety of different kinds of arrangements. But generally what that parish nurse does is not provide medical care beyond screening. He or she would provide screening. But beyond that, it would be a lot of information, needs assessment, development, identification of gaps in the healthcare system, and the initiation of new kinds of projects and programs within the congregation and the community to begin to address healthcare needs. And what they've done is they have a whole curriculum and training program where I believe they now have 700 parish nurses in local congregations across the country. Now, is Granger Westberg Lutheran himself?
Yes. Yes, he graduated with me from Augustana College.
Uh-huh. Because the Lutheran Church, the ELCA, has really adopted the parish nurse model as a model that they want to develop and replicate in Lutheran churches around the country. And actually, I understand, have developed this whole idea of every congregation being a health center, mm-hmm. which is really a very exciting idea, I think, because it means not only having perhaps a parish nurse on the staff of the congregation at the church, but also to look at the health needs of the congregation from the area, from the perspective of health and prevention rather than just medical care, so that it becomes a much more holistic, I think, kind of approach. Are any of you more familiar with this than I am? Does it ring any bells, or are you being tried in any of your churches? How many of you actually are Lutheran? Sort of? Yeah.
I'm Episcopalian.
And
I don't know what to do. I'm
going to Methodist Church.
Uh-huh. The Lutherans seem to be focusing on this a little bit more than other congregations at this point, although there's more and more activity going on around it. But there's some very exciting models actually being pioneered by the parish nurse program and this whole health center idea. Okay, so those are a couple of the things that we can do. What else?
Just be willing to pay more taxes or find revenue sources for the court.
Okay, so
all those things. Huh?
So on a personal level, it's being willing to pay more taxes. And then on an advocacy level, it's advocating for public policy which would allocate more funds for the healthcare system. Okay.
Which really, you know, ends up being much cheaper than insurance if it's universal. You don't pay much for your health care when it's equally divided.
Plus you're not contributing to the profits of the stockholders of the insurance company.
That's right. And every doctor gets paid for every visit.
Any other obvious kinds of things?
Oh. Are you talking about a personal level or state or federal or anything?
I think we're talking about a variety of things here.
You can bring the health to the people, and you know, community, mm-hmm. More community-based health centers.
So there again, it would be advocating for this, wouldn't it?
Okay. I have three children born in the United States and one in Canada, but within a week, the Canadian baby was visited by a public health nurse out in a rural home 20 miles from town with a scale, and set up an appointment for my 6-week visit and gave me two manuals, one on infant care and one from the age to 1 to 6. I was just overwhelmed.
Yeah, we should all be treated that way, shouldn't we, when we have children? Yeah.
That goes on in Minnesota.
So we're talking about change of emphasis too, yeah. From more basic health care.
Parents don't take children to pediatricians for all their inoculations.
Part of this, I know it's a really complicated issue.
Well, I think but you're talking about more. I'm
thinking the Canadian model is probably more based on basic health care. I shouldn't say just preventive, but basic health care. And isn't Oregon
yes.
Has a different kind of approach now?
Okay. We have a model of migrant community health centers. So that it's the pocket of federal money, and yet it's chronically underfunded. That would be one of the things that we could advocate for at the state and national level. But let's talk a little bit about universal access, because we keep alluding to it as something, the Canadian model, and you were talking about universal access earlier. What can you tell us about universal access at this point?
Can I take 1 minute and tell you what Nicaragua does?
Yes.
Okay.
Every
child under the age of 6 has free health care, including medications. All prenatal care is free, including medications.
And that includes immunizations for the children as well. Even in the most remote rural areas, there are community health workers who are trained and who can give immunizations. There are midwives in all these remote rural areas who do the prenatal care and do most of the deliveries. There's no barrier. As simple as that.
No financial barrier.
And this is a country that's very poor and has minimal resources.
So what does that mean in terms of a system for this country? I mean, that certainly is, that's very exciting. I totally agree with you. So what would you say about this country?
Well, the financial barriers are have to be eliminated.
What's their immunization rate?
I don't know the number, but it's very high.
There are currently 40 different healthcare bills in Congress, many of which are pointed towards universal access in one way or another. And I think that one of the things that we as church people can do is begin to advocate for that system or that proposal which we think makes the most rational sense in terms of ensuring that children and adults get the healthcare they need and deserve. Now, there's two that are getting the most of the attention. One of them is a bill that was introduced by George Mitchell from Maine, the majority leader. And this is a bill which basically builds itself on the employer buying insurance. That's the basic model. So what he's proposing, basically, is that we have an employer model, but that all those people who are not covered by employer insurance be eligible for something called AmeriCare, which would replace Medicare and would be available to people who are not otherwise eligible for Medicare now. So that if people are very low income, but they're not low income enough to get Medicare currently, they would be eligible for AmeriCare, either for purchasing it personally at a very low rate or for getting it free of charge. In addition, there's a proviso for employers that if they are a small business, for example, that they could get reimbursement from the federal government to support them providing insurance for their employees. Now, one of the basic criticisms of this bill is that insofar as a business would be getting a subsidy from the government to buy insurance for their employees, that actually the government is subsidizing the insurance industry. And the basic question is, do we want our tax dollars subsidizing the insurance industry? Now, other pieces of the bill are very good. I mean, it really is presenting a model which would cover everyone. There would be universal access one way or another. But it does not look as though it would be as preferable as the Canadian model, which is one that I guess you were talking a little bit about before. Do you know, can you tell us more about the Canadian model than what you said?
The same thing. If you're an employed person, of course, it's deducted from your paycheck. And if you're independent, you can pay, but it's a very low amount. And if an immigrant comes, or we had refugees from Nicaragua that had that kind of a status, they are automatically covered too. There isn't anyone in the country that should not be covered. I mean, I'm not saying it couldn't happen, but they have not stepped forward and identified themselves because they could get it free. And of course, the cost is so low. We don't have, I would say, we don't have that dental care into that yet, so we still have to do something. But I don't know what else you want me to say. It's incredibly cheap, huh?
Do you have a two-tiered system, too, where some people will pay privately to go to a private doctor and not use the...
Well, I'll tell you, some doctors, and we know this, and this is a big problem, some doctors will not accept it. You know, the insurance is operated by the government, and they set the doctor's fees, too. Mm-hmm. But they also evaluate doctors. Doctors can be... If they abuse, if they overcharge, if they have too many hysterectomies, they look at some of this stuff and they ask them to explain. So they have a little, they know what's going through the system, the billing. But You can, a doctor can ask additional fees above the billing schedule, but he cannot do that without the patient knowing it. And it's a problem that's one of our problems that the editorials are written about. Should that be that anyone can charge $10 more for a visit or 15 than the fee schedule is? But that would be a specialist. That would never be a general practitioner. I have not found a real problem getting to see a specialist. Some people say, you know, oh well, I think in British Columbia it's more of a problem than out. I've never found it a problem at all if I wanted to see it.
And the Canadian miles, I understand, it's administered province by province, so that if we were
That's
to look
right.
at that kind of a model in the United States, it would be a model that would be administered state by state by state. Mm-hmm. Now, one of the real benefits they estimate from adapting a kind of Canadian model in this country would be the enormous savings on administrative costs. Mm-hmm. And the General Accounting Office of the U.S. government did a study of the Canadian model in comparison to the U.S. model, and determine.
I have to meet someone, okay. So I got to move slowly, okay. So I have to start out a little early.
Thank you for coming.
Thank you. I enjoyed it very much.
They estimated that all uninsured people could be covered, and that in addition to that, either all deductibles or partial deductibles and co-payments could be eliminated, simply on the basis of the cost savings. Now, it's a very attractive model because it's working. But
we
also
don't have any deductibles.
Right. No, you don't. But when they're looking at it in terms of adopting it, using it as a model for
yes.
the United States, my understanding is that our legislators in Washington are feeling that they might want to keep some copayment or deductible as a way of regulating the amount of care which is used.
We have now if a patient wants to be admitted to a hospital, and some hospitals might have rooms with four beds in rather than all private, and if that's a choice, you might have to be willing to pay additional. That's another source of revenue if you prefer that kind of care. So they do that. Mm-hmm.
There are basically two bills in Congress now which are looking most seriously at the Canadian model. One is a bill by Representative Russo. And one is a bill which is getting a lot of attention. One is introduced by Bernie Sanders from Vermont, which is basically a wholesale borrowing of the Canadian model. But it's being taken very seriously in the federal government. I think the basic feeling in Washington is that a change is going to come. And so the message to people in churches and in the faith community, I think, is that we need to be a part of the public policy dialogue to make sure that whatever change does come is really the change that we want to see, and not a compromise that we really don't believe in. And the basic thing that you were talking about before is we're choosing between a system of universal access or a system based on an employer insured, a employer buying the insurance model. And that those are basically the two things, and we have to choose which one we think would be the better one for people in this country. The 32 communions have gotten together and are now in the process of joining something called the National Interfaith Campaign for Universal Access to Healthcare. The Evangelical Lutheran Church is among the leadership of that. And they have basically said that what they want to go with is a model of universal access. So that when you're working on this issue, you can turn to leadership in your communions, and that includes the Methodist Church and the Episcopal Church, as well as the Lutheran Church, who are taking leadership on the universal access advocacy project. We're going to have to stop because lunch is in 2 minutes. Yeah. I'm sorry, it's just, you know, it's more information than we
have. Topic.
Yeah.
But it just makes sense that we should be taking care of people, not insurance companies, it seems to me.
Right, I totally agree.
Also, the attorney at Chelan, a couple sitting at our breakfast table, said they pay $400 a month for health insurance. And you can do it for $40 a month in Canada.
I paid $500 myself, and that was several years ago. Yeah.
So when we all share, everyone can get care, huh?
Any churches outside the mainline congregations, which are many, any Christian bodies that are also, so is this some place where mainline and more fundamental evangelical people could come?
It's an interfaith organization, it's an interfaith effort, so anybody who's interested.
Well, I mean, certainly, you know.
Thank you all for coming.
Thank you.
Thanks for all your contributions.
I was just thinking of the more right-wing elements on the Protestant church, you know, like these giant community churches and.
Yeah, yeah.
More fundamentalist. I mean, they're so organized and they know how to use the media and.
Yeah.
It's a growing body and this is sort of non-controversial. And, well, I don't know, they might say socialism. You know, you might run into that hole.
Except there's so many people that are feeling the pinch. I mean, it's not just poor
people. That's true.
And a lot of those
poor people.
Yeah, something is going to change.
Mm-hmm.
And
so my son goes to a fundamentalist church, and it's a very caring, loving kind of church. Uh-huh. And they do take care of each other. If they were aware of some of these things, they might say, yeah, we've got to have some better health care for our people.
You'd be welcome to contact the National Council of Churches. You know, I'd mm-hmm. give my name to him or whatever, because, you know, I can identify the people who are working on it, and they're not people who are, would mm-hmm. say, oh, you're a fundamentalist, I don't want to work with you.
Right, yeah.
You know,
yeah, much
more, you know, we're working towards the same thing, let's do it together.
Right. Yeah.
And this effort is interfaith, and I really don't know in terms of the more theologically conservative groups. I don't know where they're coming in.
Yeah, yeah.
But there's some groups that are politically conservative that are a part of it, so.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, now, it could be a good linking area.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's probably what leverage you've got on the government.
Yes.
Other than advocating, and those insurance companies are very powerful in the medical staff.
Which I think is why the Mitchell bill is an employer payer model and not the universal access model. Because they figured that politically they wouldn't be able to pull it off.
Right.